G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Adam White, who's ready to roll. Good morning, Whitey.
Good morning, Daniel. Good morning.
Nice to have you with us.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Are you sure?
No, I'm quite good. I'm quite okay. Good. No, I'm plenty of cricket to watch over the weekend. Got up early this morning to watch Tottenham play, which was probably a little bit silly because there was no goals. But at least we got a point, so I was happy with that. Big game between Chelsea and Tottenham. So, I'm quite chipper.
Chipper? Nice work. Very nice work to have you chipper on a Monday morning. I wonder if your mate, your Tottenham mate, is as chipper as you are. Adam Ramanauskas is a Bombers champion, these days manager to the stars in the world of athlete management. And he's a special guest with us. He's not a special guest. He's part of the team Monday, Friday. He's a star. And he's with us as well this morning. Good morning, Rama.
Yes, good morning. Good morning. No, I'm a little bit the same. I feel pretty sprightly this morning, feeling pretty good, and had a nice weekend away with the family. So,
that's right. You're in a caravan park.
Yeah, watched Steve Smith dominate the weekend, which was outstanding. And then, you know, thought Coley was going to do something miraculous last night, but obviously wasn't to be. So, it was great watching cricket, great watching people in the crowd. You know, obviously the Indians in the crowd always make so much noise. It was fantastic to watch. But one thing did catch my eye this morning when I was just scrolling through Twitter, and that accident in the F1s last night.
Oh my goodness!
In Bahrain, that was very, very scary for Grosjean.
My goodness, yes, Romain Grosjean. If you haven't seen the incident, you will at some stage today. And if you're a social media trawler, you certainly will. His car split in half and hit a barrier and burst into flames. And he was stuck in the cockpit as it was flaming. What I did notice on the back of that, Ramo, apart from the fact that no one died, which is fantastic, was how quickly the staff got there to intercept or clean up the incident. They were there within 5 seconds, I reckon. As soon as the car had hit the wall, they were there, all there with 5 seconds. Unfortunately, there was a bit of a malfunction with the first fire hose. It took about 2 seconds extra, but they got there and they dealt with it beautifully and got Romain out of the danger zone as quickly as possible.
So he's ended up with some minor burns on his hands and his ankles, which is, when you see the footage of this, and as you said, Harf, people will today, how he got out of there with just some minor burns is miraculous. Those safety marshals were outstanding, just outstanding. Yep. Like, so, as you said, a malfunction, just a tiny bit, the fire hose that they had, but it was a split second. Then you saw the wall of water that was going to put the flame out, and the marshal going into the fire himself to drag Grosjean out. And he sort of like got out of it, and it's almost like, am I on fire? And the marshal obviously said, you're okay. And it's amazing that he got out of there with such minor injuries.
Yeah. Now, quite ridiculous that's all it is and all it was for Romain Grosjean in a drama-packed Bahrain Grand Prix. It was taken out, unsurprisingly, by Lewis Hamilton, who set the fastest lap, I think, in qualifying all time. He took home the race ahead of Max Verstappen. Where's our man Daniel? He finished in seventh position, Daniel Ricciardo, there in the Bahrain Grand Prix. So Lewis continues to dominate the 2020 F1 calendar. But you will see that footage of Romain Grosjean basically on fire and after his car split in half. I don't recall a car splitting in half like that.
Nah.
It was front half, back half.
I don't think they should these days.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Anyway, thankfully he's okay. Minor burns, as you say, but thankfully, he's okay, and a big tip of the cap to the marshals there that were already trackside to deal with anything. They must have, I don't know the number, somebody might be able to help us off the SMS, the number of marshals around the track, because that's such a big track and a long track, and they must be ready to go for those type of incidents in just about every section. And to get there that quickly is quite remarkable.
Yep, if they weren't there, things would have been so much different. So much different. But, I'm sure, at those those dangerous parts of the track, there's multiple marshals there. So really interesting. Something else caught my eye. Yeah, something else caught my eye, Whitey, and I think you'll enjoy this one. Obviously, with COVID running rampant through the states at the moment, they've pushed NFL games back. There's a number of players on the COVID list. Now, the Denver Broncos, they lost all their quarterbacks. Yes. So all their quarterbacks were in close contact with a positive COVID.
My boys.
But what the Denver Broncos wanted to do is they wanted to start one of their coaches as the quarterback for the team. Now, it just got me thinking that this could be Whitey. Whitey would need to do is just go over to wherever, whatever sport that he wants. Now, I'm probably thinking golf or maybe even start coaching someone at the Australian Open and just almost like, and I say this obviously with a little bit of humour behind it, but whoever you're coaching, look, you've got COVID. I'm going to have to step in for you and become the professional for the for these couple of weeks or this week.
Well, as silly as it sounds, firstly, I think it'd be a smart play, but no, but it is quite remarkable that they had four quarterbacks on their roster and they're all unavailable. But it does also show the inflexibility of NFL that they don't have someone that can actually that they trust on their playing roster that could play that particular role, that they think that it's acceptable that they would go for a coach. Now, we often talk, and Half and I particularly talk about when we see the improvisation, particularly in college football over professional football, and you wonder why it doesn't happen more often because he's so heavily structured and heavily planned. The only one I can kind of think of is Julian Edelman at the Patriots that does not play as a quarterback, but often with some play action or some improvisation does actually throw the ball. But, it's quite extraordinary to think that they would go to one of their coaches. I mean, it seriously is like, James Kelly sitting up for Essendon or Craig McRae sitting up for Hawthorne or Brent Harvey at North Melbourne.
This has got Brent Harvey written all over it, this one.
Too.
He'd be really keen for someone in 2021 to take his, maybe perhaps just fall ill. Not COVID, just maybe a sniffle. Yeah. They can't play. And they run out of spots.
Tipping a bit of stuff in the food when they're travelling.
This has got Boomer written all over it.
But I think the serious part of this discussion is the fact that there are thoughts, and look, I'm not sure I'll go this way necessarily, but there are thoughts that COVID's getting into so many teams now to the extent that maybe the season won't be able to finish. Because it's, I mean, there was meant to be a significant game on Thanksgiving Day that had to be postponed. It has to be starting to worry the NFL now.
No doubt.
So that game's still going ahead?
Yeah, it is 8:05. It starts the Broncos game, so they're using a wide receiver from their practice squad as the quarterback today.
Perfect. So that'll fix it.
Yeah. So with the coach situation, the NFL said no because what they think will happen is that teams will start to stockpile players on their coaching staff and just leave them there. And then, you know, if we do it for one person, we're going to have to do it for every other team.
You've got to get through four of them, though, before you can get to the coach. If you're recruiting ex-players as coaches to be a fifth-string quarterback to get the other four injured or sick and rely on them to win games of footy, gee whiz, that's a long bow, isn't it?
Well, that was the decision of the NFL. So
why didn't they get John Elway to come in from head office, front office?
Exactly.
They've got a man right there.
Yeah,
exactly. But Whitey makes a very, very good point. I'm interested to see now, what are they? I think they're at week 12, I think, this week, the NFL. So they've still got, a good another month before their playoffs start. I'd be interested to see if they get through because it is just... There's so many players now that are on the COVID list. Do they go into the bubble, the hub life sort of thing that a lot of other sports have implemented?
Well, it might be too late.
Mm.
Don't know.
All right, we'll see. Going back to the cricket you were talking about before, Rama, and watching it all unfold and seeing the crowd and how lively the Indian fans always are when they're watching their team play. And it's fantastic, as you say. I think it's great for cricket. I saw last night that I was thinking of Adam White when this happened, actually. I thought this is right up his alley, something he would have done, could have done. The proposal, the crowd proposal at the cricket. Rama, where a gentleman got down on bended knee and to his beloved, pulled out the ring and clearly asked her to marry him. She interestingly said yes, took the ring and they passed on hard and it was great. Could you see Whitey? Is that the place for Whitey to do those sort of things? Do you think had he been given the opportunity that was his real window of opportunity?
I would have thought KFC would have been a more likely sort of destination for Whitey. But
that's a very good call.
Cricket may have run a close second, or just on the first tee box at the Heidelberg Golf Club as well. Like just so he doesn't miss a round of golf.
Whitey?
Well,
the public proposal initially?
Of course not. And regardless of what I think about that, there needs to be two to tango to an engagement situation, a proposal situation.
Right.
And if I was to go down that path, which I wouldn't anyway, there's no way that Emma is going to get involved in that sort of activity. So, no. No, no, no.
No.
That's exactly right, Andy. That's exactly right.
Well, I reckon there's still room for you to just do get a public show of affection and just get everyone on board. Get to a venue, an event, and make it happen. Make something happen. Like renew your vows or something.
I wouldn't have thought so.
Well, there's still room.
I would not have thought so.
Don't sign off on it just yet. I think there's something there for you. Something there for you. Who were we talking about last week that was talking about KFC? Who did we interview last week?
Mitchell Beer.
Mitchell Beer, yes. Mitchell Beer was all over his KFC. Mm. He certainly was. Hey, the Jericho Cup was run on the weekend. Did you see Luke Williams' interview after his ride on Count Zero at the Jericho Cup yesterday at Warrnambool? We've got a bit of it. If you didn't see it or hear it, it was a great effort. Upstaged some of the favourites. Simon Wilde, the local, knew exactly what he was doing with that Count Zero. And Luke Williams rode Count Zero to victory. Let's have a listen to him after the win.
Well, I watched his replays and had a word to Simon, so I went into the race pretty confident. I walked the track this morning and I knew there were a couple of spots where I could seriously make ground without doing anything, if I could get to them, of course, which I did go up the hill the second time, and he just rolled up there easy, making ground beautiful. Coming down to late the final turn, I think it was McCarthy, tried to drive me onto the inside. I'm like, no, piss off, we've got to stay out here because like, it's better ground. Anyway, we stayed out there for a bit longer and made the ground we needed to, and yeah, got the job done, so it was awesome.
You said it probably ranks as your career highlight. How long have you been riding for?
Oh, shit, bloody, I suppose, a lot of years, bro. Like, I think nearly 30.
And what's the feeling like coming back to SCAR when you know you've won a $300,000 race, but a race that has so much significance behind it?
Oh, it makes me probably want to get a bit more dedicated, lose some weight and try and win another proper big one. So, yeah. No, it's good. It's a great feeling, man. Great feeling.
Great to see you in the winner's stall. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Hopefully, this is a horse that you can stick with and he can be back next year and you can chase back-to-back.
Well, hopefully, I'll ride him out of the jumps too, so that's what I'm looking forward to.
Well done, mate.
Take care. Thank you.
Great stuff. Great stuff. What a great interview there from Luke and Williams. I've been riding a while, bro. Bloody long time, bro. It makes me want to get fanning and lose a few kegs and get serious.
I hear him when he says that. Get a bit serious and lose some weight. I hear that.
He was very good. He's very good. Well done to all yesterday for another great Jericho Cup meeting. And we should mention too, and I'm sure Blue Eyes will be all over Jericho, the full blow review of the Jericho Cup meeting at Warrnambool yesterday, Trelgen Cup yesterday too, just by the way. And also the Japan Cup, where Armand Dai, the magnificent mare, finished her career. Her last ever start was a win in the Japan Cup, which was run a bit like Might and Power's Caulfield Cup all those years ago. There was a strung-out leader, Kaseki, and decided to take everyone on.
It was like the horse hadn't finished from the race before. It was so far in front.
Really put some energy into the race, which was great. But Armand Dai, the magnificent mare, 11 Group 1 wins, I think it was, or 11 wins, 9 Group 1 wins, one of those two. finishes her career as one of the greats of Japanese racing. So well done to all the racing fans and connections of Arm and I, with a great way to finish the weekend as well from a racing perspective. There's a bit going on in the world of footy in Tasmania, of course. The long search for a standalone team in Tasmania to be a part of the AFL has been gathering great momentum through the year. An AFL task force Tasmania has been set up to find a pathway to work with all the governing bodies and the people that need to get it done, to get a team into the competition. And Grant O'Brien is a part of the task force. He's a former Woolworths chief as well, and he wants to see Tassie in the AFL. He joins us on the Breakfast Club this morning. Good morning, Grant.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
We're really well, thank you, and appreciate your time in a conversation that seems to have really gathered some heat in it in the last couple of weeks. Now, I don't know how long it's been going from your end, Grant, but the conversations last week that without a real pathway to an AFL team, that the Tasmanian government should be investing their money in other areas and other sports. How serious is it getting? How dire is it getting for the situation for the task force to get a team in Tassie?
Well, it started a while ago, Daniel. We handed the task force report to the government and to the AFL approaching a year ago now. And of course, we had good momentum at that stage, I believe, and that was the feedback that we'd gotten from all parties. But then COVID hit, and of course, priorities changed, and understandably so. You know, everyone's getting their head up now and looking towards the future and what that future may look like, and the AFL is no different, and the Tasmanian government also is in the same boat looking forward. And I guess we're a little frustrated that there's no real plan that has come from the AFL in response to the task force. It's critical for anyone in this environment to be able to get the best certainty that they can in yep. order to make decisions, whether you're a government or the AFL, and we want to see it back on the agenda.
So you handed through your paper a year ago. Was there a timeline on what you expected and when from the AFL in terms of what it might look like from their perspective?
Yeah, we submitted in that a date, which was 5 years down the track, for the first game, if you like, by the standalone Tasmanian team.
Yep.
An engagement with the AFL was set aside for 2020. Obviously, that's come and gone, and again, been affected by COVID. But there are a number of decisions that are in the wind now that require a bit of direction, and one of them is the state government's support or ongoing support of the Hawks and North. And in order to make that decision, they need really line of sight as to what the future for an AFL standalone team in Tassie might look like.
Are you less confident, Grant, than you were, say, 6 months ago, that there will be a Tassie team in the AFL in the next 5 years?
No, look, we think the report is compelling. And it's not just about getting an elite team in the AFL. I think that's something that we need to be really clear on. Whilst that's dominated the report, what was also in the report is that the game in Tassie is suffering at the moment. Participation levels in boys in recent years has fallen by about 22%. So, wow. So an elite team, as has been shown in Queensland and New South Wales, the two most recent admissions to the AFL competition, spikes engagement and spikes participation. So it's about getting a team in the AFL, that's for sure. But really that's to facilitate football in a proudly football state. You know, footy's been played in Tassie since 1879. The flags that the goal umpires waved were kind of first waved in Tassie. The first boundary umpires were in Tassie. Four of the legends of our game, the Baldocks, the Hudsons, the Stewarts and the Harts, from Tassie. We had 25 players in the AFL going around the AFL last year. This is a nursery, and it's been part of the AFL for a long time, and it's effectively withering on the vine. And the AFL team can provide ambition, visibility, and access to the young people of Tassie, and really that's my motivation. For trying to get an AFL team up. But it stacks up financially, it stacks up participation wise, it will stack up, and we've got the people behind us. It's an AFL public in Tassie.
So I've got sort of two questions. One with in regards to COVID, should that change? Does it make it less likely, more likely, because of there being less money in the AFL as a result of what's happened this year?
Couple of points. The proposal is effectively underwritten by the Tasmanian government. The Tasmanian government, as it stands today, is one of the biggest sponsors in the AFL with the money it contributes towards the Hawks and North. One of the biggest sponsors in the AFL, and that's in jeopardy, really, unless there's a plan going forward here. In relation to the point about COVID, of course, it's a great point, and COVID's provided uncertainty, but what most successful businesses are doing out there now is they're looking at reinvention. They're looking at what their business needs to be in the post-COVID world. Very few businesses are putting their entity back the way it was before COVID. They're taking this opportunity, and I think there comes a point, and it'll be for the AFL, that the declining market, particularly in Tassie, requires reinvention and renewal. Otherwise, it'll become irrelevant.
Head across the ditch and have a chat to Simon Dool, former New Zealand cricketer these days. Magnificent broadcaster, because the Kiwis have got the Windies over there for a couple of T20s at the moment. Two down, one to go. In fact, it's today, later on today, at Mount Maunganui. And Simon joins us. Good morning, Simon.
Daniel, Adam, how are we, boys?
We are terrific, thank you, mate. How's the world over there in New Zealand?
Yeah, pretty good, thanks. We've got capacity crowds. We've got a little bit of cricket getting underway. The weather's been a bit dodgy, to be fair, to the start of summer, as it can sometimes be at this time of year with the changing of the seasons. But we have managed to get through a couple of games, and New Zealand had a pretty good start.
Yes, they won both of the T20s to date. And as I mentioned before, there's another one today. And as a pretty special performance yesterday, we saw from your boy Glenn Phillips, who put on 150 balls or something.
Yeah, incredible performance yesterday. I mean, it's been a guy, I guess, in Glenn Phillips that New Zealand have seen potential in for probably about 2 or 3 years now, but we haven't seen the best of him. He's had a terrific off-season. He spent his COVID time, as you said yesterday, in the gym, just basically getting powerful, getting stronger, realising that his go for New Zealand was around the T20 and 50-over formats more than anything else. Went away to the CPL, had a very good time of it in the CPL, and we just saw a little glimpse of, probably more than a glimpse yesterday, of what he can produce now. So starting to get some good numbers and some good players towards the top of that order now, given Conway making his debut as well. So real positive signs for New Zealand moving forward. We've been awful, to be fair. We've been really poor at T20 cricket in the last little while. We lost 8 in a row coming into this series, and our world ranking is well down the list.
So he's done a Bryson DeChambeau, Glenn. He's gone into the gym and got himself bigger and stronger. He's hitting it further and further.
The shakes.
That's right, exactly. It kind of feel like you said, I mean, the Kiwis haven't been great at the shortest form for a while, but this is what you need. You need it to be more than just Guptill and Kane Williamson, and to find these other players that can do it for you helps. You've got a few around the edges, but you need that next one to come through as a genuine batsman.
Yeah, I think the numbers have been a real issue for us, guys. We can probably have a good test match team, a good 50-over team, or a good T20 team if we're picking the same players time and time again. And to me, I think we need to be going down the track of picking a specialist T20 side. Yes, there will be one or two crossovers, and I think that's one thing that Australia have probably done very well and better than most, is that they've identified a T20 side and said, OK, this is our T20 team, these are our main T20 players, but they're vastly different from what our test side is going to be. New Zealand don't have the resources and the playing numbers to be able to do that, or haven't had, and I don't think we've concentrated enough on it. So this is the first step in that direction, I think, to find some specialist T20 players. Then you throw a Williamson in who can control things, captain the side, do it that way. Your Fergusons, and I don't think Tim Southee's long for the T20 side, to be honest. So your test match players, you're probably going to see a Williamson and a Bolt. And in the future, I think that's probably going to be close to it. Maybe Kyle Jamieson. So New Zealand are finally figuring that puzzle out, and we're finally getting enough players playing in some of the leagues around the world where we can identify a little bit more T20 talent. And I think that's the way forward.
Yeah, that's interesting. What about just the overall view of the summer? I've been dying to talk to you for a week or so now because the story about the Pakistan players testing positive and some of them in a cafe and all that sort of thing. What's the feeling about the summer of cricket in New Zealand?
Well, the feeling was really good. And, you know, we're going to have the odd positive case come in. And I've been in isolation. I'm on my last day. Boys, I've got one more sleep from Dubai and the IPL. So, you know, I've done 13 nights, and it's not an easy thing to be stuck in your little room and confined. I've had the golf clubs out. I'm lucky enough to have just enough room to have a few chips and a few pucks along my room, which has been good. But look, it's not easy. I can understand the temptation around it, but you know what's coming. When you come to New Zealand, you know what you've got to do. And we've been, you know, I think as a country, as a government, we've dealt with this pandemic pretty well. And to be able to have capacity crowds, to be able to go to the mall, to be able to go to, you know, school functions, to be able to go and just live your life freely, you've got to do these 14 days and do them properly. And, you know, this Pakistan side, they chose not to do that, and you know, they put the tour at risk. And I heard, I don't know whether you saw the Shoaib Akhtar piece, being an absolute chop on social media. I couldn't catch my breath. He basically accused the New Zealand government of being of just saying, look, being above their station and telling Pakistan that they should be allowed to go home, and Pakistan should have picked up their bags and left, according to Shoaib Akhtar, and gone home and said, we're not coming back here for another 5 years. So I couldn't quite believe that. But, you know, hopefully they've seen the light now and they'll behave themselves from here on in.
Settle down, Shoaib.
So just back to Phillips, will he play today? Because was his knee buckling under him in that innings? But he sprinted off the ground at the end of the innings as well. So one of the all-time great innings, but there was a bit going on with him.
What a problem to have. He's got a permanently dislocated, or dislocatable, if that's such a word, kneecap. So he's got a very loose kneecap that dislocates on him. I won't say on a regular basis, but it's happened four, five, six times in the last 6 or 7 years, I think. So it just every time it gets a little bit looser. And he basically said every time he tries to slog it to cow corner, which was quite a regular occurrence, that's when the real issue starts to occur. So they have to tape it up, strap it up quite strong and try and hold it in place. And it's been a bit of an issue for him because he's a wicketkeeper as well. For those that don't know, Glenn Phillips is a very, very good wicketkeeper as well. So it's been a lot of time, you know, up and down behind the stumps, and I don't think that's helped the situation either.
He
won't play today. We've got quite a few guys going over the hill. So the trip from Mount Maunganui to Hamilton for the test match, the likes of Tim Southey's leaving, Ross Taylor's leaving. Who else is in that squad? That's Kyle Jamieson heading over the hill for the test match. So there's a few of those guys are going to join the test squad as of today, and the side will be captained by Mitch Santner.
Well, when you give away all your draft picks, you've got to find a way to get some athletes and some potential superstars into your competition, into your system. And the Cats have always found a good way of doing that. And they've gone outside the box a little bit this time as well, with Paul Sapatolis, who's become a Category B rookie with the Cats after a very, very highly decorated underage basketball career. He's been good enough to join us this morning on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
We're going well, thank you, buddy. Nice to have you on the program. Now, what does a young man who's 202 centimetres, who's captain Victorian Metro, who's been a gold medalist for Australia at the FIBA Oceania Cup and the Asian Cup in the last couple of years, what's he doing playing football, Paul?
So I'm sure as you guys all know that I used to play footy down at Yarraville Southern Eagles for 3 years.
Yep.
And I was part of the Maribyrnong Sports Academy football program on a scholarship, and then I reckon around 14, 15 years old, basketball pretty much said to me, you know what, you got to make a decision, or, you know, you won't be able to make these Oz teams, sort of thing. And sort of same thing that happened to Luke Jackson. He had to give up the football for about 12 months. And after he finished up at the World Championships, so similar to me, we both kind of decided that we wanted to go back to footy. And it was just the small things at the clubs, like the culture, the atmosphere, what football brings and just the joy of being out on the field again.
Was there... Now, that makes sense to me because I love the game. I play it. I know exactly what you're talking about. I think it's the best game on the planet. But was there was there not significant interest or enough interest from the basketball community to tempt you to stay?
Yeah, definitely. There was a lot from especially Europe because of my background. Obviously, I'm Greek. A lot of interest in Greece. And I actually got asked to go to Olympiakos to try out. And 2 years ago, broke my foot, and then just ever since then, something popped in the way, like an Asia Cup, Oceania or tournament. So I never really got to go over. But I reckon about 2 months ago, a club in Greece said, you know, we'll sign you, you just have to be here in a month. I'm like, well, here's the contract, be in a month and you're playing. And I'm like, nah, because last year at Oceania, I told my parents, you know what, footy's what I want to do, and I'll find a way to do it.
So, you said you haven't played football, Paul, since under-13s. Yeah. Now, obviously, Geelong have signed you, but there was other clubs that I know that were interested. Yeah. How's your skill level at the moment?
All the clubs have said my skills are pretty good, so I'm just going to go off by what they say. But, like, obviously, I've never really dropped the footy out of my hand. Like, even at school, I was always kicking the footy with all the guys at school. Last year I was training with Ryan O'Keefe, Emma Sajeka, Josh Honey, Sam Ramsey. So I was always around people that are highly skilled in the AFL world. Tyron Baker, that's now at Carlton Football Club as a coach, helped me out a lot. And Anthony Koutafidis, close friend of mine, always helped me out. So I've never really lost the touch of it. More that the only thing that I lost dramatically was the endurance, but during this whole COVID pandemic, I bought a treadmill and I haven't really got off of it.
So just back to your basketball quickly. You played representative basketball with both Luke Jackson and Jay Rantel.
Yeah.
Did you speak to them upon making your decision to sign with Geelong about, you know, you mentioned before the culture and, you know, the team environment that a football club offers. Did you speak to those two boys about that?
I spoke with Luke Jackson a fair bit. So it was Asia about a year and a half ago, and he said to me, you know, I'm going to play footy after Worlds. And I'm like, it's actually funny because I'm trialling with Adelaide at this stage. Like, we're in talks. And he goes, mate, I just miss the culture. I'm like, I'm exactly the same. I couldn't agree anymore. And, yeah, no, Luke Jackson's been really good with me. He's always been there to talk to. Yeah, he's a great kid. And Dre Rantel was a great kid. He just had in footy endurance-based body from I can remember. So 15 years old, the kid could just run all day. So I was never surprised he switched over to footy.
So, firstly, what's wrong with the basketball culture for you, obviously, to switch? But you talk about the offers that you had over in Europe. What about college basketball and getting an education over in America?
I was never really interested in the college. I just wasn't interested in moving to America, especially from the stories I've heard, like, you get injured and that's it. You know, you're stuck with the education. You're not playing sport, really. You're just stuck at, say, for example, San Antonio. You're just stuck there if you're injured. If you get injured, you know, you could be sent home just like that. And kind of put me off. And I was always saying, you know, I just want to play sport for high level. And like to be that my job. But, yeah, just the culture difference. Basketball's more, you know, dog-eat-dog sort of thing. Like, it's more individualised. Footy, it's just... When I went to the Sydney Swans, I was like, Jesus, like, this is how it is. Like, everyone's just so happy for each other. Everyone gets around each other. It's just that I miss, like, messing around in the locker rooms, watching NBA, NFL, whatever it is. Everyone's just around each other all the time. And you're just in a great environment.
And so, Paul, why Geelong? Because, obviously, there were other choices that you could have potentially gone with. Did it have anything to do with the history Geelong have got in helping players that have come from other sports, or was it just the feel thing? Do you like surfing? What was the reason why you chose Geelong?
So obviously I trained at Adelaide at the start of the year, I was very happy with Adelaide, and I thought, you know, this is a club I'm going to end up at. But Geelong started talking to me, so Troy Selwood came to my house for an interview early March, so just before the pandemic, and he told me straight out what the plans were with Geelong, what they expected from me, and he told me what I expected from them, and I said, you know, just give me a chance sort of thing, and from them, until the stage four lockdown, we're training every weekend out at St. Mary's, and just the connection I grew with Troy Selwood, Stephen Wells was awesome. He pretty much said to Troy, you know, I've got trust in you to deal with this kid. And just to have the trust in a recruiter like that, like I only spoke to Stephen Wells maybe three times before I got signed. So just the like you can just tell the trust they have in each other. And obviously all the boys, they started messaging me, Joel Selwood. Yeah, it's just a connection I had to Geelong. And obviously it's only 30 minutes down the road because I'm just in Point Cook, which helped. But like I said, just the connection I had with the club.
The WBBL final was held, of course, on Saturday night at North Sydney. Didn't go the way of the team that we were barracking for, the Melbourne Stars. They lost to the Sydney Thunder by 7 wickets. It was comfortable in the end on the back of a great bowling display. And I'm sure they'd be very, very disappointed, but the Stars coach, Trent Woodall, has been good enough to join us on a Monday morning to wrap it up for us. Trent, good morning. Commiserations.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, definitely a bit sad today.
Yeah, I'm sure you've probably been sitting there in the last 48 hours just scratching your head as to how it all unfolded the way it did. Have you been able to pinpoint how and why you found yourself in such precarious situation batting first the other night?
Ismail, yeah, she was outstanding. She was outstanding. The wicket probably wasn't as flat as we thought it was. We thought, you know, it's been 40 degrees all day, hot day, get runs on the board in the final, and then squeeze them. But Ismail had a different take on that, and she bowled the house down and was a deserved player of the match. And we were never in the contest, really.
And for a team that's been so strong in that area, I mean, when wickets started to fall, was there an element of, bloody hell, what do we do now?
No, we just didn't get a chance to get back in the game. What was pleasing was that there wasn't real panic on the sidelines. There was frustration, but there wasn't a sense of everyone grab your pad. We just couldn't keep going. Nat Siver and Annabelle Sutherland had that mini partnership there, and we thought, okay, we're going to reset and we'll go from wanting 150 to 130. But then I think when Nat got out, that was the end of that. And then you're sort of hoping to get to 120 and take early wickets, but it just wasn't to be.
Now, one of the big talking points, Trent, was the flip of the bat and the decision that was made. Explain why you chose to go against what you had been doing for most of the tournament.
I think we're just pretty keen to get some runs on the board. Like I said early on, hot day, what we thought was a good wicket. It was a hot day, that didn't change, but the wicket probably wasn't as flat as we thought. And the batting group were really keen to get runs on the board as well, feeling that in a final that we could then squeeze under lights the Thunder batting group, but it just didn't work out. But I think it's really important that we don't take anything away from the Thunder's bowling performance. Ismail, that was the spell of the tournament. She was unbelievable and backed up by I think it was Sammy Joe at the other end.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, well done to her.
And I think it's important to say, Trent, that history says in WBBL matches in finals, often the team that he's batting second chokes, chasing. It's happened. And to get runs on the board in a final, whether it's men's or women's cricket, is often the way you go. So I don't think you can be criticised for doing what you did.
No, listen, we had an outstanding tournament. It was really good. And where the disappointment lies was, I think, the tournament ending, in that we embraced the Harbinger share, the Thunder, they did too. But we had a really good mindset just around how we wanted to play our cricket. It was aggressive. It took was taking the bowlers on, and then it was defending and squeezing with the ball, and it just didn't work out in the final. And to your point around, you know, batting first, runs on the board, history suggests that was a really rock solid way of trying to win a game. But it was, you know, it's really I wanted to make sure the girls weren't apologetic. They weren't embarrassed. It was
it was acknowledging the success and the ability of the opposition, and then make sure that we continue on our journey and look to be, you know, ultra aggressive next year as well.
So taking off your Stars cap and putting on your sort of developmental role with Cricket Australia, yep. I think the interesting part, and unfortunately the Stars copped the brunt of it, but as you touched on, it was won by a bowler or some bowling. And I think, yep. you know, with a tournament that for a number of years now has been so batter dominant, to see fast bowling particularly actually win a game, I think is really important for the development of the game.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, 100%. Ismail, I mean, she's in the field. The first game we played against her in the field, she was outstanding, a terrier around the boundary. And to see that game at North Sydney Oval, I think it's sort of the skeptics will always have their view on different sports or women's sports. But it was a great occasion. It was, you know, Annabelle Sutherland hit the ball out of the ground, and then Ismail bowling good pace and moving the ball was a great sight as well. So I think the tournament itself has jumped up from where it was last season, and now there's so much more riding on these games for the girls that it's actually, you know, athletic battles now where there's young girls competing for Australian places as well, and there may be some of the ones who are at the top of the tree at the start of the tournament have slipped a bit, but that pressure and that competitiveness is really driving that tournament, which is exciting to see.
So you fall one short, obviously, in the final. What will your target next season to come in?
I've lost 5 in a row, so I think I just want to not turn up to a final, maybe. I promised them at the start of the tournament that they'd have a lot of fun, that everything they did was optional other than turning up to a match. I wanted to empower them as athletes. It's sort of my mantra with the men's players that I work with, that I want to empower them to feel good about the decisions that they make. And I think we got there at the end. And I think it was a shock to them to lose because they were so used to backing themselves and getting up for the next day. Then all of a sudden, when the end of the tournament came, the trick will be making sure that we start again next year and not start where we ended, but you know, reorganise ourselves as to how we want to play next year's tournament. And that was led by Meg Lanning, who had a lot of fun. I mean, I can't speak to Meg, but she smiled a lot, she laughed a lot, she loved our practice sessions. And the girls really embraced Meg, Catherine Brunt, Matt Siver, Mignon Dupree, the overseas players, Elise Villani, last year's captain. They allowed Meg to really express herself and just be one of the girls. And I think that was important, that it was a player-led team, and that's the stage that we want to continue on next year.
So we heard from the team that didn't quite get the job done before the break, the Melbourne Stars. Let's have a chat with the team that did get it done. The Sydney Thunder women are the WBBL champions for 2020. And they did it emphatically in the final after a great bowling performance set the game up for them. Jono Deem was watching it all unfold as an assistant with the Thunder. He joins us. Good morning, Jono.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Good on you, buddy. Great to have you with us. Gee, it was a clinic by your opening bowlers in particular, Ismail and Sammy J. Johnson. They really did put in probably the spells of the tournament just at the right time.
They did, mate. They did. We talked about it through the tournament. You know, we probably didn't put our best bowling performance on the board until the last game, which is, you know, fantastic for us. Not so much for the Melbourne Stars, but credit to our girls. They stuck in through the whole tournament. It was a difficult time. There was the ups and the downs of the hub life, and to put a performance on the board like that in the GF, wow.
Yeah, it was something else. And really, I suppose at one stage through the semi, you probably weren't even thinking about final. The Brisbane Heat collapsed, and you found your way through. What was your confidence levels like going into the final?
Look, we knew we were a chance. I think T20 is a funny game, right? It's always the best team of the day in any sport, but anything can happen, as we saw in the semi-final against the Brisbane Heat. You just got to stay. For us, it's about staying in the contest as long as we can. And we knew the Stars have an extremely powerful lineup. You know, they've got some world class players. I think 8 or 9 of them, to be honest. And they're playing the best cricket through the tournament. And the best thing you can do is give yourself a chance in any tournament, and we did that by getting through to the GF, and thankfully Shabs came in and bowled a fast-ass spell early, and Samuel Johnson, I don't think they laid that on in her first 12, 12 balls. So it really set the tone for us through that start of the match.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that, Jono, because obviously it was a situation where we had Ismail taking the wickets. But Sammy Jo Johnson, she's such a big personality and she's such a dominant player the way she goes about it, bat and ball. Share us a few insights about what makes her so good.
Oh, mate, you talk about she's just such an amazing person. You know, she's a rev head at heart. You know, her game day warm-up's gone down and given her V8 a good little rev up. And she's just an amazing person around the group. So she's a bubbly, she's a character. She says it like it is. And she's obviously a big game player. She's won 3 tournaments now.
Yeah.
So, you know, for her to turn up and do the job on the day, it's no surprise, really. But I was so happy for her and the rest of the group, mate. They were awesome through the whole tournament.
And with her being her, it enables Rachel Haynes to just go about her business, and she kind of goes under the radar in the Australian team, despite her leadership there, and even in the Thunder team, she goes under the radar. She's such an underrated player.
Mate, she's an outstanding leader. She's that type of person that she stands up in front of the group to talk when it's business time and everyone listens. And, you know, she was just fantastic through that whole tournament. And I think you hit the nail on the head before and you know, said Sammy Jo just being her. We want to encourage the players to be themselves. And, you know, that came down from the head coach. Just be yourselves. Everyone has their own unique qualities and just go out and express themselves. And, you know, they did that with a smile on their face. And I'm just stoked for them.
You mentioned off the top, Jono, the challenges of hub life. Can you let us into a few of those? And do you think those little challenges just help galvanise the team?
Yeah. Look, it was, mate. First of all, like CA and everyone involved did an awesome job in setting that up. I can't imagine how hard that would have been. But you know, the time away, earlier tournament, not being able to sort of do the little things that you would normally do, like. Mate, I got to cook a barbecue in the at the later stages of the tournament, and I got to put my own sauce on my own plate. That was one of the highlights. And I got to put my tomato sauce on my own. So, you know, the little things that you would normally get in life that we weren't getting, and you know, you see in and around people that you see day in day out, you can't get away. And you know, our group was fantastic, and they set up their own little. You know, they had their own little setup on their level. They had their bean bags. They had, you know, their little games and their little chats, like staying together as a group. And, you know, Sammy Jo, for one, was big driver of that. And, you know, once the sort of tournament got towards the end, the restrictions loosened a little bit. You sort of get out and go get a coffee. And that sort of helped everyone sort of mindset, sort of refresh and, yeah, look, it was. I'm glad to be out. I'm not going to lie, but what an amazing experience!
One of the greats of modern football in the last 17 years. In fact, talk about the AFL football. It's hard to have a conversation without finding a way to get Heath Jaw into it. Former Magpie and Giant, 325 games in 17 years. A premiership player, of course, in 2010. A two-time All Australian, amongst a host of accolades through his career, and he's been good enough to join us. On the Breakfast Club. Good morning, Heath.
Good morning, boys. Thanks for having me on.
Not a problem, buddy. What's the afterlife like for you?
It's fairly low key, mate. I promised myself after I finished footy, a few mates of mine who have previously retired put on a bit of weight. So I said, if I'm going to go out and have a few drinks, I'll make sure I go for a run the next day. So I've been doing a fair bit of running. So. Trying to stay in reasonable shape.
How long do you give yourself with that system you're running?
It is getting harder and harder to track the runs. I'm going to go for a run, mate. I must admit, it was 40 degrees yesterday, so there was no chance that was happening yesterday. But I'm in reasonable shape. I've been playing a few games of cricket, just T20 games as well. So I keep myself busy, but nothing too serious.
So before we continue this conversation any further, Heath, is it definitely done, gone, finished, or is there still some light? Where do you exactly stand?
I suppose the conversation at the end of the year with Leon
and Jase McCartney. It was around the fact that was I going to retire or did I want to keep playing? And my theory in my head was sort of thinking about it for a while. I wanted to keep playing. I wanted to keep playing at the Giants. And the sort of thought process before that was like I did have a bit left in the tank. Thought I performed pretty well this year. Didn't embarrass myself too much. And I wanted to help get the team back to where I thought we should be, which is playing finals. So in my head, my thought process was I wanted to play again, but I wanted to play again at the Giants. And I think I said in an article over the weekend, playing at a third club wasn't really something that I sort of looked at. It was more along the lines of, playing again for the Giants. But that didn't pan out too well. You need both parties to agree on that before that happens. And so, just sort of fired off into the wilderness a little bit.
Well, I was playing golf with your uncle the other day, Uncle Tone, and he's sick to death of you having all the records now, so you can just about stop anyway. You're the top dog that he reckons these days. He's had enough.
Yeah, it took me a while to get there. There was a fair few moments where I didn't even get anywhere near it, but to play the 300 game was one of the best weeks I've had in football. The rest of that game and the way that panned out, and then to go past Tony this year was well worth playing that extra year. And even throughout COVID year, it was still good to tick over at 314 and get past Tony and take the mantle at the head of the family.
I want to know, Heath, how many runs you've had to go on, because you said you're going for a run after every little session with the boys. How many runs have you had to go on then over the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, there's been a few. It's funny when you're sort of, like, obviously I'm a Melbourne boy, but I've been in Sydney for 7 years now, and I wanted to get around to as many people as I could to catch up with them, have a beer or catch up, just like anyone over the journey of my time here. Go to Melbourne for Christmas, and yeah, there's been a few lunches and dinners, and usually that in a few years. I've been doing a fair bit of running, but it's been great catching up with people and telling old war stories and having a bit of a laugh.
So, if football's not on the horizon, what happens next? What does life look like for Heath Shaw moving forward?
The plan was to go overseas and spend a bit of time overseas when retirement came about, but I don't think I'll be doing that. The only overseas I'll be doing is probably going to Tasmania. At the moment, I'm probably going to have to catch up with my old mate, Swanee, and get an idea of what a gap year looks like. I want to definitely take a year off and just sort of sit back and relax and, like I said, enjoy some family time and catch up with all those people that I've missed out on the last sort of 7 years I've been up at the Giants, and no solid plans as yet. I think I've deserved a year off after playing AFL footy for 17 years. So for me, the plan is no plan, and I'll have to get some advice from Swanee on how to do that, because I think he's into the fifth year or sixth year of his gap year, so he's doing pretty well.
hey, when you look back on your career, take out the premiership, what are you most proud of? Because you've done a lot, and as you said, over a long period of time. But is there anything that kind of stands out that might be a bit different to what we think?
I suppose there's a couple of things. Takeaway, the premiership. It was, I think, like I said before, my 300th game week. That was like amazing. The way the club sort of each day we had, or each meeting, there was sort of a little bit of a snippet of people acknowledging my 300th and. Just to build up to that, and it was actually one of two times where I've had a beer in the change room. My one request from the club was to have beers in the change rooms after the game. We just all sort of sat around, had a few beers, and just enjoyed what was a great game, and just sort of looked back, and that was great. And then I suppose the other one is a bit more general, is just coming up to the Giants and being able to help, in a way, create history week in, week out with a brand new club, building them up to a team that played four finals in a row and played off in a grand final, and just helping teach and develop young kids
throughout that journey, which I never really did when I was at Collingwood because I was more of the young kid who was a bit of a rat bag, had to sort of be thrust into that leadership role and the older statesman and then have to develop my sort of teaching and learning skills around that and help improve a team that was just starting off on their journey. So those two things are probably the best things that have happened throughout my career. And then I suppose everyone says it, all the friendships you make along the way. And, yeah, football's an amazing thing because whether you play one game with someone or you play 100 games with someone or a premiership with someone, you still remember those faces. And if you walk past them in the street, you definitely say hello.
Let's talk some boxing now. Ben Damon, Fox Sports boxing reporter, has been good enough to join us on a Monday morning. Good morning, Ben.
Yeah, good morning to you fellas. Big weekend of boxing. An interesting event yesterday, that's for sure.
No doubt about that. Hard to argue with that. Mike Tyson, Roy Jones Jr., exhibition match. Firstly, before we get to the end result, let's go back to the start. How did they look in your eye when they both came out to the ring yesterday?
Yeah, well, they looked very good for men who are 54 and 51 years of age. They've obviously worked really, really hard. And you just have to bear in mind that Mike Tyson hasn't been in a professional boxing ring for 15 years. So the fact that he was in good enough condition to go 8 two-minute rounds, and frankly, he looked like he could have kept going, is pretty impressive. Roy Jones, he ran out of gas pretty early on and just decided to sort of hang on and try and stay out of trouble against a far bigger, stronger man, as it turned out, in Mike Tyson. But yeah, physically, they obviously worked really hard, got themselves in good condition, and while they looked like older versions of themselves, that makes absolute sense.
So they had two-minute rounds, had 12-ounce gloves, larger than normal gloves, just to keep it a little bit safer. The California State Athletic Commission mandated that those happen. Were there any other alterations?
Yeah, just slightly heavier than normal gloves, just to take a bit of sting out of the punches. But outside of that, well, the real difference between this and an actual professional boxing fight was that it is an exhibition. So under those terms, the referee is meant to sort of break them up whenever things are getting a bit too nasty one way or the other. He didn't really do that. He let them go and he let them hang on to each other quite a lot. He let Roy really close that distance, hang on, burn the clock and stay out of trouble quite a lot. The other really important part is that in an exhibition, there's not meant to be a winner declared, but that was never going to be satisfying for either of these fighters or for the audience watching or for those wanting to have a bet on the event. So the WBC decided they would put in three former champions to judge the fight so that a winner could be declared. And as it turned out, that was an absolute waste of time because they were really drinking heavily through the course of the fight. Vinny Pazienza, former world champion, a really interesting story himself. Yeah, he was on something while he was watching that fight. He didn't give a single round to Mike Tyson. He gave all rounds either a draw or to Roy Jones in one of the weirdest scorecards you'd ever seen. So yeah, it was the only real farce out of things was the result, but it really doesn't matter. A draw is a draw. It's fine. But if you had a bet on it, then you would rightly feel robbed because Mike Tyson won that fight.
What about the undercard with the ex-NBA player in Nate Robinson and the YouTuber? Now,
yeah.
If that's an exhibition, Nate Robinson is probably, his memories of that fight are going to be pretty hazy.
Yeah, it's quite funny that these blokes got in there and had a go and did what they did. But it's also a little bit scary that someone like Nate Robinson could have people around him who could convince him that he had the ability to go into a boxing ring. He should not have been there in the first place. And quite frankly, the referee or his corner should have pulled him out when they saw that he had absolutely no idea what he was doing. He got dropped twice by some bloke from YouTube. Then he got up again and he got caught with a massive shot and he was asleep for a long time. And thankfully, he woke back up because those sorts of shots can do a lot of damage. He won't be getting in a boxing ring again, Nate Robinson, and that is best for all of us. The other bloke, Jake Paul, he's made to look pretty good because he fought against someone who had absolutely no idea. But really, yeah, it was a circus, as we always expected it to be. But plenty would have tuned in, I think, just to watch the YouTuber, and a lot of interest in former NBA player as well. But yeah, the less of that we see, the better, and that'd be better for everyone's health as well, I think.
So now we're going to see Mike Tyson again. He's talking about having more and more fights, isn't he? Another four or five fights.
Yeah, well, I interviewed him, a week and a half ago and said, what's next, assuming you get through this one and you have fun? And he said, oh, well, yeah, I want to keep going, keep raising money for people, those people include himself. I suggested Evander Holyfield's the obvious one, a great rival of his during his heyday. He said, yeah, Evander's one. Otherwise, Anthony Joshua or Tyson Fury would be good. And I suggested that might not be a great idea, but he thinks that he would like to move around with one of the current heavyweight champions of the world. Yeah, that'd have to be a proper exhibition. Otherwise, it would be Mike Tyson looking like Nate Robinson. So I think that probably there'd be a lot that needed to be worked out in a rules sense if he's going to move around with one of those blokes. But otherwise, Evander Holyfield's the one. It makes perfect sense. They've had such a great rivalry. There's so much to talk about. There's such a great story. I think it'd be even bigger than what we saw yesterday, and yesterday was enormous.
That was the best of The Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.